I'm John Krall. Today on the special Recorded No Limits, we're going to talk with Holocaust survivor Eva Moses Kaur, who is the subject of an upcoming documentary, with Ted Green, the filmmaker who did the documentary, and with Peggy Tierney, who is the publisher of Eva's book, Surviving the Angel of Death. Because this is a recorded program, we are not able to take calls or emails or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded No Limits, which means we're not going to be able to take phone calls, email messages, or questions or comments via social media, but I know you are going to enjoy this conversation because it is a special one. We are talking with Eva Moses Kaur, filmmaker Ted Green, and publisher Peggy Tierney. She is the publisher of Tanglewood Children's Books, about, well, the specific news hook is a fabulous new documentary that is coming out soon and will be broadcast on WFYI called Eva, that is about Eva's life. And there are events associated with that. But more importantly, we're going to be talking about Eva, her story, and her journey today. So I should say to Ted, Eva, and Peggy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
It is really wonderful to have you here. So I'm gonna start with you, Eva, as is appropriate.
Okay.
I think, you know, what I know you're a little bit of an old hand at this, but what is it like seeing your life story?
It is surreal in some way. I know it's my life story. I know it happened. It looks a little bit different when you hear your own words coming back at you. It's much louder, it's much clearer, and it has a little bit of a surreal. Is that what really happened? I am very, very happy with the way the film came out. It is very well put together. A lot of work went in it, and my great hope is that the people who will view it will learn something that will enrich their own lives.
Yeah, we are going to talk about the larger subject because I found some of the themes in the film to be really, really fascinating. Ted, what drew you to doing this story?
Well, I mean, I had never heard of Eva, actually, when someone said, why don't you come over to Butler University? I live right by there and listen to her speak. And I was absolutely mesmerized, I would say, as everybody else is when they hear her speak for the first time. But I was also kind of mesmerized by the hold that she had on the crowd. I mean, 2,000 people were there at Clues Hall, and not one of them was looking anywhere but at this one little woman right up in the front wearing the blue. And I thought, man, you don't see that very often. There really must be something to this woman. And so the first thing I did, actually, was I read Surviving the Angel of Death, published by Peggy over there, which is written by Eva. And I know it's a young adult book, supposedly, but I would say it's also a very adult book as well. And I would advise anybody who's interested in Eva's story to really start with that. It tells her story at Auschwitz so well. And then after that, I wanted to go over to Candles in Terre Haute to introduce myself and to see if she would actually do this. And I know she was very skeptical. But a question that I had after reading the book, which talks about her forgiveness as well, but I wanted to know what came next. I wanted to know what came after Auschwitz, which you really don't see a lot of reporting done on that. And so that's what really drove me, to learn it for myself so then I could show it to other people.
Peggy, what drew you to the story? Because in some ways, you did what Ted has done, but in a different medium.
Yeah, so I was living and working in Washington, D.C., and we had decided to move to Terre Haute, Indiana, and I was reading the paper one day right before we moved, and I read about a Holocaust museum that had been firebombed, burnt down, and I read about the woman who had founded it, Eva Kaur, and she just sounded so amazingly positive for someone whose life work had just been burned to the ground. And then after we moved to Terre Haute, I kept reading about her more in the newspaper, and the efforts I knew to rebuild the museum were successful. And again, she just had such a remarkably positive take on it. And I read about her forgiveness. So when the museum reopened, I went in and I got her self-published book and I took it home and read it. And I just thought, this is an extraordinary story. I have to publish this. Kids need to hear this story. But Eva hadn't been there the day I'd gone in and got the book. But so I went back in when she was there, and I met her, and I said, look, you don't know me, you know, but I'm in publishing. I've been in publishing for 8 years. I just started a company. I'd like to publish your story. And she said, okay. That was it. So, I didn't know that she'd been thinking about wanting a children's book anyway, but, you know, it was just
so
okay.
She had a much easier time with this than you did. Yeah. That's really not the way it worked for you.
Didn't really work that way for me, nor through the whole process. But, we dragged her kicking and screaming.
So, yeah. Go ahead, Eva.
Yeah, anyway, even the publishing took a while.
3 years.
We did three rewrites, I think, and ultimately, I wasn't sure it was going to come to see the light of day, but it did. And I'm glad.
So, Eva, we probably, to do justice, so there, I think most people who are listening to this do know something of your story, and we've made allusions to the fact you're a Holocaust survivor, but the specifics are far greater than that. Well, could you talk a little bit about your story?
I have survived, actually, the worst of the Nazi death camps, Auschwitz. My twin sister and I were used as human guinea pigs in Dr. Mengele's experiments. And unfortunately, I have received the worst of it. I was between life and death. Mengele injected me with something that... By next day, I felt extremely ill. My fever was very high. I was trembling as the August sun was burning my skin. My legs and arms were swollen and painful, and I had red spots throughout my body. And so one of the experiments where they took me to the blood lab and tied both of my arms, took a lot of blood from one arm and gave me a lot of injections and the other. But this day, instead of tying my arms, they measured my fever, and I was surprised that they knew I was sick, but of course they knew. And then they immediately took me to the hospital that was filled with people that looked to me more dead than alive. Mengele came in next morning, looked at my fever chart. He never examined me, which was to me strange. He just looked at my fever chart and he said, too bad. She's so young, she has only 2 weeks to live. I knew he was right, but I refused to die. And this was the second silent pledge that I made, that I will survive, prove Mengele wrong, and I will be reunited with my sister. And I did not know how sick I was going to be, but I was for the next 2 weeks. I was crawling on the barrack floor because I couldn't walk. I was crawling to reach a faucet with water because this barrack wasn't even allocated water. And I do not exactly understand where I got this unbelievable will to live, but I was not even going to give up. Even as I was fading in and out of consciousness, crawling on the barrack floor, I kept telling myself, I must survive. And I did.
And if you are just joining us, this is a special recorded No Limits. We're talking with Eva Kaur, who is a Holocaust survivor, a Mengele twin, the filmmaker and the publisher who have told her story, Ted Green and Peggy Tierney. I want to talk because the losses you sustained there were tremendous. You and your twin survived, although she suffered, obviously, from that treatment for most of the remainder of her life. And you lost the rest of your family in that experience, correct?
Correct. Everybody was killed. There was only one aunt, my father's younger sister, Aunt Irena, who survived, who took us in after the war, and God bless her, because I realize today if she wouldn't have taken in, we would have ended up in an orphanage, which was not a very good place. So at least she tried to give us a roof over our head. How do you deal with that? I have no idea. You take one day at a time. As we were in Romania for 5 years, there were a lot of stories that so-and-so returned. So each day we were hoping that somebody from our family would return. And that was going on for the 5 years we were in Romania. But nobody did. And in 1950, we immigrated to Israel. And that was a new leaf in my life. In Israel, I never thought there were not much talk about people returning. There were some survivors. But I also had to learn about a new life. And luckily, I was placed in an agricultural school that was designed to help these Holocaust survivors somewhat heal. And I found it amazing that we were taught immediately that we were accepted and worked in the farm. It was unbelievably therapeutic for a child who just survived deaths, diseases, and Mengele, to be able to do something good with my hands. Mm-hmm. That was very therapeutic. And I think that society should look into that, because these were the best 2 years of my life. I felt much, much better after we were graduated from the school, and then we were drafted into the Israeli army, which I spent the following 8 years in Israel in the Israeli army, reaching the rank of sergeant major.
Should emphasize here, too, that when you went into the camp, you were about the age of a first grader, right?
Not went.
Well, we're
was
taken. I know. I misspoke. You were. You did not go by choice. No one would. But when you were taken into the camp, you were about the age of a first grader here. Now, this story is going to be told in...
No. I was 10 years old.
10 years old.
Yes, I was a fourth grader. I was middle of the fourth grade when
that's
we were
right.
taken
you went
away.
To, you went to Dachau first.
No.
I thought so.
We
oh.
were under Nazi occupation
okay.
for 4 years, but we were at home.
Okay.
And so. Then the Hungarian Jews hoped they would escape Hitler's final solution and we would not be taken, but we were picked up in March, about this time, middle of March, taken to a ghetto, and 2 months later in May, middle of May, we arrived in Auschwitz, 1944.
Okay. Ted, this story is going to be unfolded in several ways. We've got a big event coming up in just about a week, right?
April 5th. April 5th at Clues Hall, which is actually where I saw Eva speak for the very first time. I think that's a really nice place to do. And also, Eva's son, Alex, is a proud Butler graduate.
Okay. And it's going to be shown. Are there tickets still available, or is it a sellout?
Yeah, it was sold out. Then we had a few returns, people who couldn't come from out of state.
Okay.
So we have less than 100 left, and I'm told they're going very quickly. So people can still get on there. Go to our website, which is thestoryofeva.com.
Okay, and what is the cost to attend?
It's $40 for the night.
It's
$40. And it's, they are planning, I'm not planning, I'm just a storyteller, but mm-hmm. they're planning quite a to-do at this, and I think it's going to be a heck of an event.
Okay, and you know, then the broadcast premiere for the people who cannot make it to Clues that evening.
Well, the first thing I want to talk about is 9 days later, April 14th, there is going to be a premiere of this in Terre Haute at Indiana State University Tilson Auditorium. That premiere is being run by Eva's museum, Candles. And so anybody who's interested in that should absolutely contact the Candles Holocaust Museum in Terre Haute. And then we will do, after that, we hope to hit the film festival circuit over the summer. And then so we are going to hold off our initial broadcast until the fall. I believe it has been set for October 25th.
We are talking today on No Limits, in this special recorded No Limits, with Eva Kaur, Ted Green, and Peggy Tierney. We're talking about Eva's story, which is the subject of a fabulous new documentary called Simply Eva. Because this is a recorded program, we are not able to take questions or comments via phone, email, or social media, but we do hope you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today in this special recorded No Limits with Eva Moses Kaur. She is a Holocaust survivor and the subject of a new film and a book. The film is Eva, and it is done by one of my other guests, filmmaker Ted Green. And the book is Surviving the Angel of Death, and its publisher, Peggy Tierney, she is the publisher of Tanglewood Children's Books, is with us as well. So I want to talk, I'll start with Peggy on this one, but what it is about Eva's story that you think touches people at the level that it does? What is it that speaks so powerfully? That's the kind of question I can't ask her because it invites her to be, sound self-centered. But
I think one thing that makes it so dramatic in a way is that she was a child, that she was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And to, you know, have this child in the most evil of circumstances is just so moving. And I think everybody can relate when she talks about losing her family in the camp, the moment mm-hmm. when her mother is dragged away. And also just to be so inspired by her life afterwards, to be able to do so much with her life.
So. Ted, what do you think it is that people respond to so powerfully?
Well, I guess I think they respond to what I respond to, is it the amazing this one person who, through sheer will and determination. Mm-hmm. And empathy, a person who went through the very worst of the worst as a young child at mm-hmm. 10, as Peggy was saying. You know, those of us who have children, you think, how could our kid have gone through that? That she was able to go through all that and with the same faults and frailties as all of us, which I do show in the film, what she was able to accomplish in her life, the good she has set out to do for mankind and is still doing today at age 84. I want people to walk away from the film both flabbergasted at that and also thinking, well, you know, maybe I can't be an Eva, mm-hmm. but maybe I can do something to help the world as well. I think Eva is driven by, she wants to bring out action toward that end in other people. And I'm hoping the film will help inspire that really around the world. I don't think there's too many people alive who can inspire that as well as she does. And I've seen it.
I want to pick up on something Ted said. Eva, would you want other people to be Evas? I know you said, you know, that they can't be, but to be who you are, they'd have to go through what you have gone through.
No. I don't think people have to suffer as much as I have.
Yeah, well, no, and I'm not talking about the empathy and all of that, because a lot of your story does come from the experience that you had to surmount.
What I am hoping, at least, that people will take notice that they don't have to remain victims the rest of their lives, if they have been victimized, which we all are victimized in life, that they have a choice, and they would try my simple idea of trying to forgive those who have hurt them, and by doing so, they are going to heal themselves and be happy. And if a person is healed, a person does not want to lash out and hurt other people. This is the reason that, in my opinion, and I believe it with my whole heart, that forgiveness is a simple act of self-healing, but it's also the key to world peace.
And I want to talk about that, because that's, I think, one of the more powerful moments in the film and obviously in your story. And it wasn't, getting to forgiveness was not an effortless journey for you. You were almost 60, right, before you got to that point?
Correct.
And could you talk a little bit about the steps you had to walk along the way to get there?
I mean, the steps that I don't think that they were necessarily the steps that one has to take. I will tell you that the most interesting thing was that in 1986, I was arrested in Washington, D.C., and I was tremendously traumatized. And I was so scared even to go. I didn't want to go back to Washington, D.C. again. I thought somehow everybody was against me there, because it seemed like everybody was against me. And then in 1993, where at my own initiative, but I was lucky to meet a Nazi doctor who was willing to meet with me. And I was very scared, but I was suddenly treated with respect and caring. That was such a difference from the being arrested in Washington, D.C., and being treated by a Nazi. And both of them were so unnatural. I didn't expect to be arrested in D.C., and I did not expect to be treated with respect and kindness by a Nazi doctor. Mm-hmm. And so that, to me, was an unbelievable thing, that a Nazi would treat me that way. And what evolved from that meeting was, and I do not exactly understand how everything happened, but it evolved that I asked him if he knew about the gas chambers in Auschwitz. And he told me that that was a nightmare that he was living with every day, and that after he was stationed outside looking through a peephole, and where people were dead, he signed a death certificate. I've never heard about it. I have read many books about Auschwitz, many books from Sonderkommando. Nothing ever, any document called the death certificate that was signed. So I just blurted out, I said, you know, I'm going to Auschwitz. I would like you to go with me and sign a document at the ruins of the gas chamber, just like what you told me. And he said, I would love to. So from there on, I strangely, and I still think it's very strange, I wanted to thank this Nazi doctor for his willingness to document the gas chamber. Because I said, if I ever meet people who say the Holocaust didn't happen, I could take that document and shove it in their face. Mm-hmm. But to thank a Nazi, that sounded strange. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't share that idea with anybody, because I didn't want anybody to talk me out of it. And it took me 10 months of everyday brainstorming by myself. How do I thank a Nazi? I didn't know. And after 10 months, a simple idea popped into my head that I realized immediately it would be a meaningful gift, a letter of forgiveness from me, the survivor of Auschwitz, to the Nazi doctor. But when I discovered that, I also realized that it was life-changing for me. That I discovered that I had the power to forgive, No one could give it to me. No one could take it away. It all was mine to use it in any way I wished. And that was the secret.
I've got two questions that come out of this. One, you talk about it was in effect a gift you could give yourself here. What was the impact on you and your life? And then do you know what the impact was on the doctor when he received the letter?
He grabbed it as I was signing the document at the ruins of the gas chamber in Auschwitz. And I said, don't grab it. It's for you. Just let all the witnesses sign it too, so there would be witnesses. He was tremendously relieved. And you could tell he said, that is a gift that I didn't expect. For me, it freed me from being a victim. It changed my whole life around. I could not change anything that happened to me up to that time, and there were many nasty things. But I could forgive everybody and be at peace with myself and the world. And that is a very powerful thing. If people have not tried it, that you have even power over the people who were the evil people. That was I didn't have forgiving Mengele to be able to do that, to forgive the angel of death of Auschwitz. It was unbelievable. And there was nothing that anybody could do to change that. It was my doing at my own will, and by doing so, I changed my life.
And in changing, you were, I think by your own admission, consumed by, understandably, a great deal of anger following this. Did you find out of that that you were released from at least some of that anger? Or is
completely,
still
without the shadow of a doubt. I even even the day when the museum was burned the next day, people would come up to me and say, are you going to forgive the people who burned your museum? I said, I must, because I do not want that evil deed to be something that I would be involved in. I also want to rebuild the museum because I don't ever want evil to win. And if I don't rebuild the museum, that evil act would have won.
So I'm going to ask this, and I'm going to start with Ted and Peggy on this, in part because I think it's not really fair to ask either of you to follow Eva.
It never is.
On this. The subject of forgiveness fascinates me. An interview probably a couple of years ago where I was talking with a couple of members of the parent circle who worked toward reconciliation in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I was talking with an Israeli mother who had lost her son and a Palestinian father who had lost his daughter to, obviously, the opposite side in both conflicts. And I remember Palestinian father, whose daughter was only 10 years old when she died, was killed, was asked how he would respond, and he had said he was going to forgive the Israeli soldier who had killed his daughter. But he said, forgiveness is a more complicated thing than people realize. And he said, it's a direct quote, I'm going to forgive him without mercy. And by that, he meant I'm in some ways going to liberate myself from the evil of this act, but that doesn't necessarily liberate him. He's got to do his own work. On that, do we misunderstand you know, this whole idea of forgiveness and think that it's the equivalent of a Monopoly get out of jail card or whatever, when it really is a much deeper human experience than that.
Well, I have a hard time speaking for Eva on this, but I do think that with her forgiveness is a lot like the forgiveness you just described. One of the big criticisms of Eva that I think is unfair is people think that she's, by forgiving, she's also forgetting. Mm-hmm. She is that is the very last thing she is doing. She's devoted her life, part of her life, to keeping the lessons of the Holocaust alive. I think her forgiveness is really an act of, it's very much about herself. It's not about the perpetrator. It's not about any religion. It is an act of self-liberation so that she doesn't have to let these evil things that were done to her hold her back for the rest of her life. And I think that she is also advocating that others try that, and not just about the Holocaust, but in other things that have happened to them. And yeah, do I have a hard time sometimes? I put myself in that shoe, and can I always see it the same way she does? No, I struggle with it at times. But I will say that I've never gone through anything like Eva Kaur has. Mm-hmm. And I will also say I have talked to countless people who have tried her method of forgiveness and had it change their lives, in many cases, save their lives. So when you see this, when you see the good it's doing, when you see it open people up and allow them to live full and rich and happy lives again, you think, who am I to judge against this? So, you know, I really do, even though I have a hard time sometimes imagining it myself, I sort of mm-hmm. do stand back and applaud at the good that it is doing people.
Peggy.
I think that Eva's forgiveness is a wonderful option for kids and people who have been hurt by someone where there shouldn't be reconciliation. And I used to work in child welfare, and I know that kids, if they've been abused or just had some, you know, really awful things happen to them, it's really unhealthy for them to have a forgiveness where they're saying, oh, it's okay what mm-hmm. you did. To be able to say, it wasn't okay what you did, and yet I'm going to move on. And I'm going to get over this. That's the best possible scenario.
Okay, Eva.
Well, I just want to remind Peggy that we were in Romania, where the Romanian students in that high school where I attended many years earlier held her book, and they understood mm-hmm. my message. They were 100% in tune with it. They like the idea that when I have difficulty, I don't give up. Later on, I forgive. And then they stood up and danced the Israeli dance, the Hora, I enjoy life. Mm-hmm. And I would like that picture of the Romanian student dancing to show me that they understood what life was, my philosophy was all about, that everybody deserves to be happy and free. And if society doesn't give it to you, you take it in any way you can.
Yeah, and I should say, to be fair to the moment I was talking about with the Palestinian father and the Israeli mother, there was another point in that conversation when the mother was talking about the son that she had lost. And understandably, she broke down and started crying. And it was the Palestinian father who reached across and held her hand. And, you know, gestures like that, human gestures like that, I think at some level represent the hope for the rest of us.
Yeah.
What was your relationship? We've only got about 40 seconds here. But what was your relationship like with that doctor, the Nazi doctor after
this? I was in touch with him until he died.
And how long ago did he die?
2001. Yeah.
Were your communications warm, or were they more perfect?
Very.
Very warm.
Very.
So it brought some peace to both of you to be able to
Correct.
Get to that side. We are talking with Holocaust survivor Mengele twin Eva Moses Kaur, who is the subject of a new documentary by filmmaker Ted Green, another one of our guests. And has also written a book published by Tanglewood Children's Books. We're talking with publisher Peggy Tierney. of that book here on No Limits. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we are not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope that you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today in this special recorded No Limits with Eva Moses Kaur. She is a Holocaust survivor, one of the Mengele twins, and now an international advocate for forgiveness and reconciliation. She is also the subject of a new documentary called Simply Eva, and we've got the filmmaker Ted Green with us. He is going to be talking about that, and the publisher of Eva's book, Surviving the Angel of Death, Peggy Tierney. You wanted to jump in there. Did I say something incorrect,
Yes, Eva? You made something incorrect.
All right. What did I do?
Welcome to my workshop.
Forgiveness and reconciliation are very different.
Okay.
Reconciliation, and I want to make that clear, you need two people to reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
In forgiveness, you need just the person who's tired of hurting, and therefore there is a very big difference.
It's true. But let me ask this, and obviously I'm wandering off my strategy for the interview here, but you raise an interesting point. Do you hope out of forgiveness for reconciliation? Do you hope that the folks on the other side of the equation will acknowledge, hey, yes, I did do wrong here?
I'm not even hoping that, because that is even too complicated. Mm-hmm. You're entering now the me taking in consideration other people's thinking.
Okay.
Basically, forgiveness, the beauty of forgiveness is that it's very simple. You don't need anybody else to agree with you. You have the power to forgive, and by doing so, to free yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So the simplicity of the forgiveness is, and the benefit to the victim, that you, the victim, are tired of hurting, and you can make the decision to forgive. You do not need anybody to approve it, accept it, or permit you to do so. And for the victim, that is a very big thing, because up to that time, you needed everybody to run your life. And now you can do it all on your own. And that is the reason that I think forgiveness works much better than reconciliation, where you always need at least two sides to agree to it. And that is where it becomes complicated.
Well, admittedly, I guess you're not opposed, though, to reconciliation. You're not opposed to other people.
I am not opposed to reconciliation, and whatever good comes out of forgiveness, it can grow into bigger and better things. But I want that first step. Because who are the people who want to kill other people? Victims who are very angry. They want to get even. So if I can stop the victims from being angry by healing themselves, then they are not going to want to get even. And that is very important.
Okay.
It's a simple idea. I see its benefits working for me and working for other people. And if I can do just that, that is pretty good.
So let me ask this, because I think this is a fascinating, and it's in there, in this. Do you think it is possible for, we were talking about the Nazi doctor. You forgave him.
Yes.
Do you think it should be possible for him to forgive himself?
I am not sure. That is a lot more complicated. People have asked me, how do I forgive myself? I don't know how you forgive yourself for something you have done wrong. You try to remedy it. You try to do the right thing. You try to tell the people you have hurt. But do not expect the people you have hurt to jump on the idea and forgive. Because that might take a lot of time. But the effort to forgive himself should be tried, even if it's not very successful. There is a benefit in the realization that I was wrong in what I did and I want to remedy it. That is the first step. And I don't think that people should try ever to do the right thing in their life. Because I would say it's never too late to try to do the right thing.
Well, and I understand your distinction between forgiveness and reconciliation. It seems to me that one, forgiveness has to be a step toward reconciliation, if that is at all possible. But the other piece of that, I guess, is doesn't the benefits that you're talking about, don't they apply on the other side? That even if, say, Ted had done wrong to Peggy here, and Ted acknowledges that he has done wrong, and he says so to Peggy and asks for forgiveness, even if Peggy is not willing to extend that forgiveness, there's still value in Ted acknowledging that he has done wrong.
That's correct. Okay. I believe that that's correct. But I don't really think that after forgiveness, reconciliation is a must. Or it's a natural conclusion.
And I would agree with you there.
And I don't really even want to worry about it. As a survivor, as a victim who has survived, I want to worry about making my life better in the simplest way I can. And forgiveness is the simplest way. If it results in something good, so be it.
So I want to switch gears ever so slightly here, and I'll start with Peggy on this. What were you mentioned earlier in the show, or actually Eva mentioned it, because apparently the experience was one she remembers. Clearly that she had to go through writing three drafts for you when the book was published. What was the hardest thing about telling this story, about telling Eva's story?
So the first thing was that English is Eva's fourth language. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I would need to hire a writer, and that writer would not just tell the story but capture her voice. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. So we actually didn't just go through three rewrites. We went through three writers. And the third one finally really brought it to life and captured Eva's voice. And then because the writer was in California, I had to do a lot of the interviewing, and I had to do a lot of research. And I was surprised how little has been written about Dr. Mengele. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. But.
So what was the trick in capturing Eva's voice? I agree with you. It's an incredibly distinctive one. And I don't just mean the vocal timbre and all of that, but the way she speaks, the way she frames arguments and all of that. There's probably no one else but Eva who could speak to that.
The funny thing is that I had this realization about what made her so strong as a speaker and the book in the writing is that the first two writers actually tried to put too much emotion in it. They felt like I'm telling this dramatic story, and so I have to have all this dramatic language, and it's not Eva's way. One of the most effective things is that she tells a story so simply and without an ounce of self-pity. And so it leaves room for us to put the emotion into it, to put our emotion in those spaces that she leaves for us. So that's what really kind of had to happen.
The first form was a Jewish writer, and she didn't want to deal with forgiveness. She kept moving the forgiveness out of the book.
Right, yes. And that was after I'd hired her, and she knew about forgiveness and said, oh, I can't have my name on a book that has forgiveness in it, very late in the process. So that didn't work out.
Okay. Yeah. Ted, how about with you? What was the toughest thing about telling the story?
Well, I think the biggest challenge, which is also the biggest opportunity, was that so much of her full story had not been told before. There was really this middle act of a half century, of 50 years, from 1945, her liberation from Auschwitz, to 1995, where she came to a forgiveness. That, you know, it, as a researcher, I kept looking and looking and assuming I would find something, and very little had been done about it. In fact, I'll say that that first time I talked about when I drove over to Candles to talk to her, she alluded earlier to her arrest in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. Well, at that point, we were just talking. I'm just trying to get to know her, and she mentioned, oh, yes, and I was actually arrested one time, but we won't be going into that. Well, as a journalist, you know, no, you're like, wait a second. I looked right at her executive director at the time, and he said, kind of gave me the don't worry sign. And that's when I really redoubled my efforts to find out what had happened. And let me tell you, those 50 years, I found to be tremendously revealing. I think that Eva, to her great credit, showed great courage in going there, where she really hadn't gone with too many people before, and opening up about what were some very, very difficult moments. And I think what that has allowed the film to do is it makes Eva more relatable. You know, they don't have to view Eva as this saint up on high, that there's no way I can. It's really nice that she can do all these nice things, but I could never do that because I'm not a saint. Well, Eva's the first one to say she's not a saint either. So I think showing that side of her will humanize her in a great way. And I also think it puts into remarkable relief how far she has come. And I think that's the most telling part of the documentary. And the fact that it took a while, but the fact that she was willing to open up in some really, really deep and emotional conversations about that is really what makes this film different.
So I'm going to ask you, what were the most difficult, were there difficult parts of your story to tell, things that you were reluctant to share?
Yeah, I didn't really want to go to the arrest. The arrest is probably the most brutal thing that I have experienced after the Holocaust. And it was brutally done. I don't know why. One of the detectives was so brutal, he tore my right rotator cuff, so I still cannot raise my right arm. But it was the experience was, I knew that they wouldn't like me protesting. But I didn't expect to be brutalized. I really didn't. This was the Capitol Rotunda of United States of America, with all the members of Congress there, all the world press there, Vice President there, Elie Wiesel there, and nobody even wondered if I lived or died, much less ever asked me a question. So I said, I am safer in Auschwitz today than I am in the Capitol Rotunda. That is what my conclusion was.
So let me ask this, and I've been struck by a phrase that Peggy used in describing the way you tell your story. She said, you say it in the most simple terms, but you tell it without self-pity. And that, you know, you deal with this pretty matter-of-factly. You talked about the determination to stay alive when you were in Auschwitz. And I know you said you don't know where that came from, but do you understand where your qualities of determination, or was that something your parents passed on to you?
There is something that I came to realize lately, and I say to people, would I have cried in Auschwitz? I would not have had the state of mind to think of a way to surviving. So getting involved in self-pity for any length of time takes away your ability to reason out how to live. And that is true for today or for any time in life. If the mind doesn't work at the same time, oh, poor me, and I'm going to find a solution to how to solve this problem. My solution was how to survive there. It was very immediate, and there was no room for error. So self-pity disappeared. And I would say that that is true for every human being on every situation. If we are going to teach our children to survive in this world, we better not over-pity them. Because it doesn't work. The human mind does not work that way.
So in terms of dealing with this, were there ever times you felt reluctant to talk about what you have been through?
Never. I never felt reluctant. But I usually, whatever people ask me, I said what I felt or how I thought about it. I never seemed to think that it was wrong to talk about it if somebody wanted to know. I was always surprised that people wanted to know about it. And I'm surprised even today.
Was it ever therapeutic to talk about it?
I would say absolutely. I didn't understand it, but with lecturing, I found my own therapy.
And did you find, there actually was a reasonable cohort of Holocaust survivors here in Indiana at one time. Did you find any comfort in sharing experiences with them, or?
I have met with them one time, and we have told our stories, and I have recorded it with a cassette. I found it amazing of how much mileage we covered in space in traveling in different places. But they were a lot more inclined to feel sorry for themselves, and I didn't. I felt always proud that I beat the odds and I survived.
And that you made it through.
Right.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to be inspired by your story. And to serve that end, Ted probably ought to talk to people about the ways they're going to be able to see this film. And I want to emphasize again, I have seen it. It's a remarkable piece of work. People are going to love it.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate that. A lot of people put a lot of time into this, certainly not just myself.
I know. It's a collaborative enterprise.
Very much collaborative. I want to thank personally my co-producer, Micah Brown, as well. It's going to be shown for the first time, the world premiere in a few days, April 5th at Clues Hall on the Butler campus. And then it will be shown 9 days later in Terre Haute, Eva's hometown, at Indiana State University Tilson Auditorium. And then we are already taking requests for screenings really all over the country right now. We plan to do the film festival circuit this summer. We just signed up for a Google Talk in New York City. Eva and I, we're going to play the documentary there as well. And because a lot of these film festivals, you can't have a broadcast or sell DVDs too early. That disqualifies you. So we're holding off on the actual first broadcast until the fall, I believe October 25th here on WFYI.
Well, we will look forward to all of that. I'd like to thank all of you, Ted Green and Peggy
Thank
Tierney.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And most of all, Eva, I'd like to thank you. It has been a privilege to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank our listeners. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.